once more into the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of the second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach on this August 18th, 2018. So it's 8/18/2018, and if it is 8/18/2018 where you are, well, that kind of rhymes, doesn't it? It just goes together. Then you're certainly welcome to give us a call at 254-773-1400, or you can email us at either jeff@tpwc.com or Jake@tpwc.com, and we will respond to your email.
All right.
Let's see. Yeah, there was something to do with the markets that's important. Interesting if you're a geek.
That's us.
Yeah.
I represent that comment.
The 10-year Treasury note is the benchmark interest rate for the United States.
Yeah.
And it's an indication that the rest of the bond market pretty much follows. And the 10-year Treasury note is in the 2.85 range. It was up at 3.11 90 days ago. It's been declining ever since.
2.87 now, yeah.
And so what does that mean? Well, it means that the collective wisdom of the people who invest in 10-year Treasury notes or in the bond market in general is that the United States will not be going as strong over the next decade as it's going right now. In other words, it jumped upward because there was an anticipation that we were on a long-term expansion, and not coincidentally, about the time the tariffs were announced, it started sliding down. Now, at the same time, the current economy is going at pretty much maximum possible speed. So the Federal Reserve, and we now have year over year in the Consumer Price Index, 2.9% rounded to 3% inflation. So it's the Federal Reserve's job to raise short-term interest rates to take money and liquidity out of the economy to slow things down so that we don't overheat and wind up with runaway inflation like we have seen in Venezuela and a number of other places. Turkey and other places. So the Federal Reserve is doing a good job of maintaining the quality control on the dollar by raising interest rates, but meanwhile, longer-term rates are sliding downhill. So the difference between the 2-year Treasury and the 10-year Treasury is watched pretty closely by economists. And the reason is, once the 10-year Treasury yield gets lower than the 2-year Treasury yield, we call that an inverted yield curve, and historically, there's no guarantee that anything about the future, but historically, within 18 months following an inverted yield curve that stays inverted, we have a recession. And a recession is when the economy is overheated and built up too much stuff, and there's not enough people to buy it, in essence.
Now, and I'm going to throw one other piece in here.
Well, let me throw the... We have now dropped below 25 basis points, it's 0.25%, between the 2 and 10 year. Almost every time that's ever happened, within 3 or 4 years, we have a recession.
Right. Well, 3 or 4 years, usually we have recessions anyway in 3 or 4 years.
Well, it is a precursor. It means that right. We're probably in what's called the last quarter.
Let's explain why that is. Generally speaking, if you give somebody a loan for a short term, you're going to charge less interest or no interest, even if it's just a really, really quick hair. Go get a hot dog and pay me back when you've got change. Then you come forward to, all right, I need some help with my rent this month. I'll pay you back next month. Well, you might start charging an interest rate on that. And if it's somebody that's, you know, they're going to pay you, you don't charge them a lot of interest. When you start talking about loaning money away for 30 years, 10 years, 30 years, any long period of time, you want to make sure, one, that the money is safe so that you get a return of your money, not just on your money. And then two, that the return that you have on the money is enough to keep up with inflation. Well, what is inflation running right now? For 2018, so far our inflation has been running on average about 2.9%. 2.9% inflation. What is the 30-year U.S. Treasury charging right now? 3.03%. So when you look at the real rates on, for instance, the 10-year has a 2.87%. That's less than inflation. That means that if you loan the federal government money for 10 years, you're going to get the money that you loaned back if we don't have more inflation than we've had so far this year. And that's a problem. This is when interest rates get to be higher for the short term, people tend to loan for the short term and not the long term, which is really, really hard for businesses. And if you think about from a bank's perspective, if we've got a 2.9% interest rate, inflation rate, and you get a loan for your house at four and a quarter, then that's not enough money to keep the bank profitable. If they've got a 30-year loan that they're going to make a little over 1% a year on, why don't they just put it in another bank and get 1% a year on it? Why would they loan it to you if you have the opportunity of failing to pay their money back? So when we're talking about interest rates the way we are, it's a sign of issues in the future.
I can tell you why they will loan the money to you.
Yeah, good. You do that because there are
because
some reasons.
We have a market for mortgages in the United States that is implicitly or maybe non-implicitly backed by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
Right.
And
by the federal government.
And thereby by the Congress. So that if the bank loans you money for 30 years at 4.25%,
they can still
they're gonna
sell
lose
it.
They're going to lose about a quarter point in selling it.
Mm-hmm.
So they in essence get 4%. And they have an implicit guarantee that if you don't pay the money back, the United States government will pay back 80% of the value of the original value of the house at the time of the loans, which is why they require 20% down payment in many cases.
Right.
In some cases, you get guarantees for the rest of it. So the issue is, if I can get 4% on my money, and I get a 1% above inflation return on my money with zero risk, and I'm willing to lock it up for that long, I might be interested in doing that, which is why mortgage rates are running at 4-point-something percent, with inflation running nearly 3%. The problem is the combination of tariffs and an overheating economy have a tremendous potential at this point to run prices up faster than 3%. Now, prior to the tariffs, we were insulated largely from inflation by the fact that if we raise prices on many things in the United States. Now, the plumbers have gone up way more than 3% a year and over the last year, and so have the electricians and so on. But I'm talking about the things you buy from Amazon or the things you buy at Walmart or whatever. We have been protected from rises in prices by the fact that you could import things so cheaply that in the United States, people who made things couldn't raise the prices because you could always buy it cheaper by importing it from overseas. Now,
right.
With the tariffs, it
gets a little harder.
We automatically kick in a level of inflation. And by the way, we have not seen the impact, probably won't until the end of this year, beginning of next year, where for instance, 50% increase in the cost of steel begins to have an impact, and the tariffs on things imported from from Canada. And if you're buying lumber or you're buying paper at this point, you have already seen the prices go up substantially on what you're buying.
Yeah.
And in many cases, it's hard to pass that through to consumers. And that's one of the reasons, by the way, we're getting housing starts falling off is because it costs a lot more to build a house. And people look at that and say, whoa, wait a minute. Why did my house price jump 25%? Well, because
right.
There's a lot of steel and there's a lot of lumber in your house.
And people, this is one of the leading indicators that we look at is durable good orders from the consumer level. Well, what's a durable good? A washing machine or a dryer or a vehicle or a freezer or a refrigerator. One of the first tariffs was on washing machines, and washing machine sales have dropped through the floor because prices have come up on washing machines. People have been waiting to buy a washing machine, and they say, hey, there's some pretty good new washing machines out there. They go and they look at the price and they go, never mind, we'll wait. Ours works well enough for now, which causes even local manufacturers of washing machines to be in some pain.
Yeah, yeah.
So we've got a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, I have a question about military contractors. I don't know how many of the contracts are fixed price, but if they are, how do they deal with the increase in raw materials, i.e. steel? Do they just get hosed and have to eat it? I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Thanks for the call.
All depends on the contract. In some cases, the contract is cost plus, which is a pretty standard contract. If it's a fixed contract, if they came in, the government got a deal on that one, and they said, we'll build you a vehicle that's got a lot of steel in it, and we'll build it for this price, and we'll make this bid, or we'll build an airplane with a lot of aluminum in it, and we'll charge you this much. In other cases, in that case, the contractor's going to lose money. There are cost-plus contracts, and they're pretty common, particularly in a military contract, whereby they said, the materials cost, we'll do appropriate competitive bidding for the materials, but we will charge this much above the materials cost of the product that we're bidding for, we're buying for you.
Right. So there are issues with contracts kind of across the board, not just governmental. If the contract was not written in a way that took into account the fact that the price of steel, aluminum, and a lot of the other manufacturing components just took a big jump upward, there's some other areas. This is kind of on the same subject. Copper has dropped in price drastically.
Yeah, about 20%.
While steel is up 50% here, copper has dropped 20%. Now, why is that? Why should we care about that? Well, because copper is used extensively in electronics and in home building and in washing machine construction, all the things that steel is used in. It's pretty rare to have steel used without copper being involved. And same's true with aluminum. Even the cans that you use to drink with, it's not pure aluminum. It's got copper in it. Otherwise, it would be too brittle to bend. It would break in your hand. So they have a copper alloy that's added to it. What it's saying is that people are buying less copper, probably because they're buying less steel and less aluminum. And that's a dampening effect on innovation, on ongoing business structures. This is why we have prices going up in other positions.
Matter of fact, in one of the oddities is we have a 20% drop in the price of copper, despite the fact there's a threat of, and maybe at this moment, a strike at one of the largest copper mines in the world down in Chile. And normally a strike like that would cause a spike in the price of copper. In this particular case, the copper price stayed down about 20%. And the bottom line to it is, copper, by the way, is called Dr. Copper. And it's what's called one of the base metals. And base metals across the board have been falling, which is an indication that globally something is out of whack in the economy. Just like in the United States, despite the fact that there are current and lagging economic indicators, and that's things like employment and sales, that Walmart just record sales, record margins,
right,
at Walmart.
Right.
These are lagging economic indicators because they actually are from the second quarter. Those look really good, although they've actually sagged a little bit. But the difficulty is when we look at the long-term leading economic indicators,
they don't look good.
Pretty much universally, they're sagging, and some of them are sagging quite a bit.
The overall leading indicators say we're still in good shape. But we're starting to see the longest indicators starting to slump.
And it's kind of like if you're near the coast and the barometer starts to drop, or if you're anywhere
right.
else. And I've got a thermometer, digital thermometer thing that I keep in my office at home. And I take it out when I do astrophotography. And it has a little weather forecaster on it. And the weather forecaster on there says it's either getting more cloudy or it's likely to rain. It isn't particularly accurate, but it's probably accurate about 60% of the time. And it does it strictly off of air pressure.
Right.
If the barometric pressure is dropping, we're more likely to have clouds and rain. If it's rising, we are more likely to have clear skies. And what we're seeing is these extremely long-term indicators are pointing downward. And matter of fact, we have a series of indicators that all point to 2020 and say that'll be the time for a recession. For example, companies are starting to build up inventories.
Yeah.
Retail companies are starting to build up the inventories because there's so much sales going on that they don't want to lose sales because they don't have something on the shelf.
Right.
So they're beginning to stock the warehouses and stock the back room and put more stuff on the shelf so as not to miss the sales.
That's a normal, we would call that a maturing cycle of a retail consumer boom, because at the beginning of it, you're just selling it as fast as you can. You don't have time to order enough more. It gets in and it sells. Once you have the breathing room to say we need to order more inventory, it means that sales are starting to slow a little bit. But people still have that mentality of, I got to get more stuff so I can sell more stuff, so they start ordering more and filling up their inventories.
You know, and this is a normal economic cycle. The issue that economists are having right now, and this is the one we've been talking about, is, and it's pretty much worked out according to economic theory so far, and that is, you can run the deficit up tremendously, you can borrow a tremendous amount of money and spend a lot of money at the governmental level, and there's no question in the short term that will provide tremendous stimulation to the economy. And it is.
Yeah, absolutely.
The difficulty is, it's just like providing tremendous stimulation to the happiness and well-being and prosperity of your house by going out with your credit cards and buying a bunch of stuff and new stereo equipment and new everything else and putting it in your house. You feel a lot better. You really look prosperous to your neighbors.
But
everything
looks
really good. You've
got to pay the credit card bill.
But the problem is, there's a price to pay. And to give you an example, we were looking at putting a different kind of, putting a bigger water heater in near one of our bathrooms in the house, because that particular bathroom was an add-on, and it has a tiny little water heater, and you really couldn't take a bath because there wasn't enough.
You could. It was just a very shallow bath.
Yes. So there just really wasn't enough hot water in there for a person to take a bath or a shower. So we wanted to put in, of course, we're not on, there's no natural gas where we are, so we wanted to put in a larger hot water heater, and we had the plumber come out and look at it and said, well, to do that, you're going to need a new electric circuit because you've used up all the electric circuits in your house. That's what's called capacity utilization. We looked at that and realized that that would mean running a trench across our entire yard. In other words, it would have been $10,000+, $10,000 to $12,000.
It's a nice water heater.
Before we bought the water heater. Now, that's called capacity utilization. In other words, we hit the wall. Now, we in fact found
a solution. Couldn't put any more electric, couldn't put any more hot water in.
Well, we actually found a solution, and that's the thing that...
New technology.
We went tankless, right? We went tankless, but still the tankless wouldn't work because we didn't have the extra amperage. What we did is put a gas tank outside the house, filled it up with propane, and put a tankless water heater outside the house.
Right.
But then there's ways of getting around. For example, let me give you an example. Let's just say that we're talking about the deficit being too high and unsustainable. And the reason it's too high and unsustainable is not just because we have a deficit. It's because we're not making anything to create more performance down the road with the borrowed money. If you're
right.
In a business and you borrow money to expand your business and you have carefully researched and said, if I expand my business, I can make more profits, then over a period of time, the extra profits will pay back the loan. On the other hand, if you give everybody a tax cut,
this is like taking everybody out to a steak dinner,
right,
with the same amount of money that you could have used to build a new machine for the company,
right. And in this particular case, had the Trump administration come in and said, okay, first off, we're not going to cut taxes. Secondly, we're going to borrow an extra $1.5 trillion, which they're doing every year now anyway, and we're going to use it to beef up our infrastructure system, because frankly, folks, 10 to 12% of the bridges in the United States are no longer completely serviceable.
You would have heard us clapping of it on this, because infrastructure investment by the government is something that leads to the ability for businesses in the United States to ship more stuff, to create right. more things, and that's where we're bottlenecked right now. We can't ship enough. There's people in there. We don't have enough trucks. We don't have enough truck drivers.
Even if they'd come in and said, you know, we've got a shortage of trucks and truck drivers, and there's several solutions. That one is we're going to offer a lot of scholarships for truck drivers.
We're going to give a tax credit for anybody that buys a specific type of big rig. That's
yeah.
the same sort of thing that they did for electric vehicles.
Or for wind.
So that's still spending. It's still governmental mm-hmm. spending, and we don't have the revenue to do that, so it would still be borrowing.
And it generates more tax money going down the road.
Right.
In other words, it's an investment. Now, on the other hand, it's like a company that instead that has the ability to build on to its factories because it's got we're doing record business and buy new equipment and ultimately hire some people and instead says, I tell you what we're going to do. We're going to give all our shareholders a special dividend and take all our profits and we're actually going to go out and borrow a bunch of money and give all our shareholders a special dividend because that'll raise the price of the shares of the company and all the options that the executives get will go up and they will all become fabulously wealthy.
Yeah.
By the way, a lot of companies have done that over the years and you don't know who they are today because they no longer exist.
So what we're looking at politically right now, there used to be a line that said if you were a Democrat, you were probably more likely to be socialist. If you're a Republican, you are probably more likely to be capitalist. We already covered that there's no purity in socialism or in capitalism. You've got to have some of the other involved or it fails. We can't look at any political party right now and say they stand for capitalism or they stand for socialism. Because when we're talking about trade, tariffs, that's a socialistic move. It is a level the playing field. This is not about merit. This is not about competition. This is about our team needs to win. It's a valid viewpoint. Throughout history, it's led to inflation, and it hasn't led to healthy business following it. This used to be the motto of the Democrats. Well, now what we have in the political world is a very muddled situation where you can't really tell what party stands for what anymore. And that's important to say because we're talking about the economy. When we come out about the economy, it's quite funny. The things that we used to say and the Democrats would be so angry at us for, talking about competition and about free trade, it's now Republicans that are angry at us for it. And it's funny because it wasn't that long ago that they were the cheerleaders, and now it's the Democrats that are the cheerleaders for free trade, even though half of them still are all about unions and socialism. So it's a very strange situation. I'm trying to derive as much enjoyment as I can from the current political climate. I know that's hard to do, but the enjoyment that I am getting is in watching the shifting of the structures and how the platforms of the different parties are kind of being traded at this point. It's fascinating to watch.
You know, one of the things that we have commented on is we thought that there's a reason behind the slow productivity growth in the United States workforce, and there's two of them that have come out and become more and more obvious recently. One is pretty clear that highly productive older workers are retiring,
right.
And low productive younger workers, they're low productivity because they don't know what they're doing yet. They haven't been trained. We had a 2.9% annualized jump in productivity in the United States in July. And now if you look at it from a year ago, it's only up 1.3%, which sounds contradictory. But at the same time, if you look back during the month of July, because we get the employment numbers out every week, number of hires, you'll notice there was a little bit of a disappointment because the companies were not hiring as many people as they have earlier in the expansion. Frankly, they can't find people to hire. And so they are slowing down on their hiring, not because they don't want to hire people. If you look, as a matter of fact, there was an advertisement on KTEM last hour, at the beginning of the hour, for the fact that they have job openings available. And if you go to any retail store, just about anywhere you want to go, you see now accepting applications, now hiring. You see it on the back of trucks. So the bottom line to it is the productivity jumped 2.9 because those younger workers, they're bringing fewer younger workers into the system now, and they are raising the productivity because they've been there a little longer. For whatever it's worth, unit labor costs jumped 0.9%. Productivity jumped 2.9 above that. So we're getting, again, this is late economic cycle behavior, but we are getting the productivity return back into the system simply because of demographics.
And I'm going to throw in a third point that we have talked about for productivity. We've also talked about it for the people that are not in the workforce that used to be, that aren't old enough to be retired, and that's the opioid epidemic. You can call it epidemic, call it whatever. There's a drug problem with prescription drugs. I complain on this radio program quite a bit about the number of people that we kill on the road every year. 38,000 people last year we killed in traffic accidents. 90,000 Americans died from drug overdoses last year, and the vast majority, this is a huge majority of those, were not illegal drugs. They're prescription drugs. So we have the president's talking about that this morning. We have a real problem there, and it is going to continue to affect the economy going forward. When we kill more people with drug overdoses than we do times three of the automobile accidents.
On the other hand, we don't need to attack this with a sledgehammer.
No, we can't. We cannot
cut it by one third.
Right. That's a regulation that would be similar to something that the Obama administration would say. Let's just do this. And this is the sort of thing that the Trump administration has been canceling everywhere. This needs to be something that goes in the doctor's education, continuing education going forward. The government should take a step into that, because most of that continuing education on pain relief is funded by the same companies that the prescriptions are being written from. So there is a massive conflict there. This is where capitalism and socialism have mixed in a way that is destructive to both sides. The medicine that we get today is a nasty hodgepodge of socialism and capitalism. It's the worst parts of each piece of it. When there's a capitalist country that's able to, or a company that's able to make a huge amount of profit because the government's involved, not because it's competition, that's not good for anybody.
Do we have a caller?
We do. We have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Disagree with what you said. There's no difference basically in the people who want tariffs and socialism and things like this. The reason that the Democrats are against these tariffs right now is because they're Trump's idea. I think Trump is put those tariffs on there. I mean, what he said, it is obvious thing, is to try to level the field there, or do away with tariffs completely, what he's trying to do with the European Union, you know, and give everybody the same advantage. And, you know, with our productivity and innovation, I think we can win in that. But
okay. I'm not sure what you're disagreeing with. I wasn't claiming that the Republicans are consciously going out and becoming socialists, but you said it as well, level the playing field. That's a fairness socialism concept. That's not competitive. If you take it to a sports analogy, if you've got a team that the average age is getting older, and they say they refuse to play with anyone else unless the other people tie one portion of their anatomy behind themselves, that's leveling the playing field, because one side has accepted that they're not going to get better. So that I'm not saying that the Democrats are suddenly changing their coats, although they are. So are the Republicans. What the definition of what a Democrat is and what a Republican is changing. And it's based on one or two people involved on each side. Whether it's the president or one of the majority leader in the House on the or the minority leader in the House, it doesn't really matter. There's a cult of a personality that's taking over that is shifting the structure of what each party believes in. You were going to say something there.
Talking about tariffs, there's a couple of things here that I think are important when we talk about leveling the playing field. Historically, what we found, and this is true throughout all the 20th and 19th and 20th century, tariffs generate tariffs.
Yeah.
Removal of tariffs, along with diplomacy and maybe some sanctions in other areas, have a tendency to remove tariffs and go to that level playing field. What we saw is leading up, for example, to World War One. World War One was fundamentally created by tariffs. World War Two, to a large extent, was created by tariffs. Tariffs are a weapon of war. That's why it's called a trade war. And everything that we know about economic history says tariffs, putting in place tariffs to eliminate the other guy's tariffs.
It's like punching someone to keep him from punching you. It turns into a bigger fight more often than it turns into a peace.
It's never worked in history. It's kind of like market timing. It seems perfectly logical and simple to do when you look at the market in retrospect. It's just that nobody, and I mean nobody, has ever been successful at market timing over a long period of time. They may get lucky a couple of times, and then they wind up blowing up and going broke, which is what happened to the majority of the hedge funds. Frankly, I think we're making some good progress in the United States and in the world. As tariffs dropped, the economic well-being of literally every country participating in world trade went up.
And let's say something very clear. I want everybody to hear this. There are a lot of countries out there that have some pretty nasty trade policies across the board. China's one of them. Japan, for many years, would not allow any American products to be sold in Japan. I mean, they just limited it right out. So in the 1980s, we had a big conversation about whether or not we should put a bunch of tariffs on the Japanese automobiles that were coming in because we were not allowed to sell American automobiles to Japan. Putting a tariff on Japanese goods caused them to put higher tariffs on our goods. It didn't cause them to take our tariffs away. And it takes long negotiations to get those tariffs to go away with lot of detail on how do we solve issues when a country in the middle of semi-free trade starts instituting tariffs. We've just done it.
For instance, I have never heard any economic justification to putting a 25% tariff on steel imported from Canada.
There's not a strategic threat. There's not a when it comes down to our overall trade with Canada, the imbalance goes the other way.
The only rationale I've heard, and the president said this, is I don't like Pierre Trudeau. I mean, he said that. I didn't. And the fact that Newsprint, which most of which comes from Canada at this point.
Newsprint. I thought you said moose print.
Newsprint.
There are moose.
Other words, the stuff that causes newspapers to be able to publish has a 30% tariff on it. And by the way, that caused the price of newsprint in the United States to go up by 30%.
So books and newspapers just went way up just in time for back to school.
And it is, maybe there's some rationale to it that has been unpublished. I've been unable to find it. Irrational tariff imposition, suddenly, the way it's been done, the founding fathers recognized to be very damaging to any economy because it means that you can't predict what something will cost, so you can't do business planning, and you don't know when it's going to come and when it's going
to
go away.
Which is why tariffs were the responsibility of Congress. Congress has passed some of that responsibility on to the president, and the president is taking the responsibility.
Firmly believe in the Constitution, and that the Constitution was correct, and that the founding fathers were correct in saying that tariffs could only be applied by Congress, not by the president. In 1962, the Congress of the United States trusted John Kennedy enough to give him emergency tariff authority if there was a strategic threat to the United States.
And that's a valid use for it. If there's strategic danger.
Well,
I don't see how newsprint is that.
The president has again and again and again said the reasons for his tariffs, and they, none of them have anything to do with strategic. Maybe some of them do, but none of them I've seen has to do with strategic threats. It belongs in Congress where there can be a debate, where the public information can come out, there can be hearings, and we can make a collective decision that there's a strategic threat. If there's a strategic threat to the steel industry, I am quite confident that Congress would recognize it, the American people would recognize it, and when Congress imposed a tariff, it would work.
Or not. You know, because the majority of the tariffs that have been imposed in the United States have been by Congress, and they didn't work then either.
But I mean, the political process of imposing the tariff would work. For instance, on the automobiles from Europe being tariffed because they have a 10% tariff on there is a 10% tariff on U.S. automobiles imported into Europe. But what people don't talk about is the fact that you don't see light trucks from Europe running around in the United States. In other words, individual vehicles. These commercial trucks.
Right.
And the reason is because we have a 25% tariff already in place on the importation of light trucks, that's pickup trucks basically, from any European country. Now, we don't have a 25% tariff on them if we import them from Japan. We have a small tariff. We do have a tariff on importations, 10% tariff on importation from Japan, which is why Japan decided to make most of the light trucks in the United States, but they're becoming prohibitively expensive.
So, coming forward here, there's another piece to the negotiation that it's very difficult to talk about. Because it sounds like I'm talking badly about the president. You don't hear that for a second. The difficulty in negotiating in this way is that it shows a very clear and stark contrast from one presidency to the next. If you have a trade agreement, and Mexico and Canada both had a trade agreement with us, we had a trade agreement that was in the works with the Pacific Rim, the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Which, incidentally, is now in place.
Right, it's in place. We're not part of it. What it says in the negotiations going forward is this may only be good as long as your president, whomever the your is, because somebody else can just change their mind as soon as they're elected. And if you think back to the caller was talking about contract work and so on, if you're a company, you don't make a contract that says till the end of a given presidency. You do it till your job is done. And if you've got a negotiation as a company with other companies in another country and you're buying parts from them, you don't make your contract with that company based on the election date of the president, because that's not free trade. That's governmental controlled trade. That is part of the definition of socialism. So when we talk about tariffs as socialism, it's what it is. The tax that comes from that does not go to the steel industry. If they're collecting 25% tariffs on steel, they're not turning around and giving that money to United States steel manufacturers. It goes to the government coffers. It causes the deficit to come down a little bit, but not as much as the lack of revenue that we got from the tax cut. And we've got a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, this Kenneth Kushner.
Hello?
Yes?
Yeah, this Kenneth.
I'm sorry, I can't understand what you're saying.
Never mind?
Okay.
All right.
Thanks for the call. Okay, we've got to play a commercial. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. The phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400. We'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And Con is standing in the door, frothing at the bit, ready to jump in here and get on the air in about
12 minutes.
About 12 minutes from now, he's going to be on the air, and he will be assailing the air with truly conservative principles. The trouble is go around to all the school and find a conservative principal.
Yeah.
represent them.
You know, yeah. Speaking of conservative principles, I was very pleased to see George Will writing, who is the, I guess he is now the dean of conservatives, that the deficit that we have created with the tax cuts and the spending increases will create a financial crisis. Not may create, but will create a financial crisis down the road. I happen to agree with him completely. And I've asked for this again and again and again, and no one has responded. I want a conservative to explain to me why borrowing $1 trillion a year to give people a tax cut so they can create Walmarts, so they can cause Walmart to have record sales and record profit margins, which is in essence the essence of what's going on. In essence, the essence of what's going on.
Right.
Is a good idea. It's utterly beyond my comprehension why the United States should borrow a lot of money so people can buy a lot of stuff so Walmart can have regular, unless you own Walmart stock. Now, if you own Walmart stock, basically the United States is borrowing money that winds up in Walmart stock value. There's something weird going on there. And I've asked. I need a conservative who's willing to discuss this on the show.
That's willing to defend
it's why willing to discuss borrow, this.
I haven't found anybody willing to defend it. That's the thing.
It is, and Con wrote, or create more welfare. The fact is, we didn't raise the welfare rolls. They're shrinking like mad. The problem isn't we're creating more welfare. The trouble is we're just borrowing money so that people buy stuff at Walmart and Walmart.
Yeah, we gave it a tax cut when we were already borrowing a big chunk of the budget. We just borrowed a bigger chunk and gave a tax cut. So, I mean, I can understand the mentality. I don't like paying taxes either. But we got to pay for the stuff that we're spending. It's we got to do it.
I think it's important that there's a completely different subject here. I want to change, other than the fact that Walmart sales rise at the fastest clip in more than 10 years, which is, I think, significant in the economy. But there's another subject, and it comes up multiple times a week. I see news stories because of it's in the Wall Street Journal, but it's not on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. It's in Financial Times, and it's in the industry publications that we get. Violation of fiduciary duty, violation of written company procedures. Scott Trade is the last one that just got kicked back down to Massachusetts State. And the Attorney General of Massachusetts going after Scott Trade, because Scott Trade said if you're dealing with an IRA, you will deal with it as a fiduciary in the client's best interest. Well, when the DOL rule, which you may never have heard of, was ruled to be bad by the courts, and it was dropped by the Trump administration, Scott Trade didn't change their policies. They still said we're going to operate in the client's best or the customer's best interest, and in fact they weren't. And they had sales contests for things that were more profitable for Scott Trade. And there's a court battle going on. We've got one attorney general in the entire United States that's going after Scott Trade for that. But there's one of the things that's really important to recognize if you're dealing with a stockbroker, if you're dealing with a registered representative, if you're dealing with a financial advisor. They're very different from an independent investment advisor who will say, I'm acting as a fiduciary and will act as a fiduciary in everything I'm doing. They have a lot of conflicts of interest in what may look like the best deal. Can turn out to be the worst deal. A prime example, they just saw a report this week that if you look at the average non-traded real estate investment trust investment that has been made over the last 20 years by members of the public, the net return is a big negative number. And why do people buy a non-traded, quote, alternative investment and put it in their portfolio? Because the price is carried on there at the price that you paid for it. And they sometimes edge the price up each year based on income or some kind of false information. I say false information, that's probably not a good term. Information that is questionable, let's put it like this.
Let me give an example. Say that there is a specific Rubik's Cube. Everybody knows what a Rubik's Cube is, but it's only valuable to you and to me. it's valuable to me because you say, give me $20 and I'll hold this Rubik's Cube for you, and it's never lost value. The whole time I've owned this Rubik's Cube, it's always been worth $20. So I give you $20. You're holding it for me. You are renting this Rubik's Cube out occasionally, and some of the pennies that you get from renting it out, you add to it. It's worth $20. Now, if you go to the store to find a Rubik's Cube, I'm going to do that right now. How much is the Rubik's Cube worth? Let's see.
$2.99.
$2.99. Well,
it all depends on where you get it. You can get them for up to $22.99.
Okay, this $20 one that you let me buy, that you're managing for me, it's still worth $20, right? And you would say, well, yeah, that's what you paid me for it.
I just found one for 89 cents.
Okay, so the reality is that the open market has a lot better method of valuing things that are selling today. If you're not planning on selling that Rubik's Cube and I'm not planning on selling that Rubik's Cube, you can just put it down on paper. It's worth $20. But the reality of the situation is if you went to sell that Rubik's Cube, it's probably not worth $20 unless you find another person willing to have a sentimental value associated with it. A non-traded anything, whether it's a real estate investment or a Rubik's Cube, you can put the price on it at the last trade. If it's not traded, that means there's nobody there to say, well, that's not what I got when I sold it. So that's the danger associated with looking at a piece of paper to get the value of a non-traded something. Because the value may not be that whole concept during the recession of mark-to-market. There's no market associated with that value.
The point I wanted to make is that it's a tremendous amount of these alternative investments that made your portfolio look very stable and reported income. And sometimes, in some cases, we're paying income. And the vast majority of them have lost money when it came time to sell them. And there may be a few that made money. I couldn't act. And this is the odd thing. In all my looking around for publicly available non-traded real estate investment trusts, which used to be really, really popular and still are to some degree, as a quote alternative investment, I couldn't find one that had a net profit. In many cases, they paid income over the years, and the people said, look, I got a 4% income on this or something to that effect. The problem with getting that 4% income and having that income over the years is actually they were returning your principal to you and you were being taxed on it. But the issue is that when you go to a financial advisor, there's a better than even chance, and I would say a very high probability, that they're involved in sales competitions or incentives if they sell so much of this stuff over here that's more profitable to the broker-dealer. And there is a scandal, I wouldn't say a scandal a week, I would say it's more often a scandal every day or two, that's reported in the press. It doesn't make a big deal because it's only it's only $20 million or $200 million or something like that that they basically are getting hammered over. But it's just one of those things you really need to be aware of, is that if you go to somebody who is a, quote, financial advisor, end quote, that person, by definition, is working for a company and has the incentives being given to that person to make a profit for that company far more than make a profit for you. And if you want to have objective investment advice, and we're not, obviously we are an investment advisory firm, we're a fiduciary firm, so we're maybe a little prejudiced in this. If you want to have objective investment advice and you have enough money that it counts, for instance, if you have a retirement portfolio enough to live on for the rest of your life, I can't tell you how important it is that you find an independent, qualified fiduciary investment advisor, preferably one that is, I know this is going to sound esoteric, ERISA qualified in their fiduciary stance. Otherwise, you are funding somebody else's retirement instead of your own. And it's just one of those things that, and I bring this up because...
Maybe as well as your own, instead.
But, well, to some degree, it's going to be instead, because I've definitely encountered people who are back at work because they lost their money that they invested. But that's neither here nor there. It's really important to just be aware of the fact that if you're dealing with a financial advisor, and there's a place for financial advisors, you're dealing with what's called a caveat emptor relationship. You're dealing with a buyer beware relationship. And when you say you've read the prospectus carefully, read the prospectus carefully.
Right. That's it. That when people, when there's a disclaimer on there, please, you know, in a commercial, read the prospectus carefully before investing. The reason why it's in small print, the reason why they say it fast is because they're not the ones that chose to have that little message on there. Somebody said to them, you've got to have this message on there so that people are aware of the risks and what you're getting paid and all of that good stuff. So if you sign something that says you've read and understood the prospectus, you should probably read and understand the prospectus. It says how much the commission is on a given mutual fund purchase. It talks about how much money you are giving up in order to invest there rather than at a place with less commission involved. So know what you're paying. I mean, if you hired somebody to mow your lawn, hopefully you know what you're going to pay them. We're about out of time, though. If you'd like to call us off the air, we've got voicemail waiting locally at
254-947-1111.
Or you can reach that number toll-free, 1-800-914-PLAN. It's 800-914-7526. You can email us directly, Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com. That's thepersonalwealthcoach.com. You can go there or tpwc.com, listen to podcasts and so on. Until next week. We have sincerely enjoyed this program, and we'll see you next week.